and welcome to The Wire, independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station. I'm Shane Anderson. Today on the show, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has made the states a new offer on school funding, labelling the deal Gonski 2.0. The proposed funding review seeks to increase the Commonwealth's recurrent financial support to schools by 75% over the next decade. This comes as the government has been locked in a bitter dispute with state governments over funding for both private and public schools. Education expert David Gonski has been commissioned to deliver his second independent report on funding for the future of schools. Here is Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull speaking on the schools funding review earlier today.
Now, there is no more important responsibility than teaching the next generation of Australians, giving them every opportunity to succeed. And yet the truth is, the performance of Australian students in reading, science and maths in particular has been falling. Now, today's announcement is about turning those results around.
And the federal government has confirmed it will build Sydney's second airport at Badgerys Creek after Sydney Airport declined their first option to take on the project. The company said it would be too great a financial risk for their investors. Further details about the new airport are expected to be released in next week's budget. More coming up later on The Wire. With the government's federal budget only 1 week away, the changes to tertiary education are firming up as a hot-button issue. While Federal Education Minister Simon Birmingham has described the changes as fair and measured, they have been slammed by university students. The opposition to the cuts puts the plans in a precarious position and has even drawn the ire of CEO of Universities Australia, Belinda Robinson. Miles Holbrook-Walk has his story.
Quite measured, quite modest and quite balanced. We've worked very hard to ensure we come up with a proposal that for students sees them face, yes, a modest increase in fees.
I don't think it's really fair for us students here because it's very hard to get a job once we do graduate. So having a lower wage, we're usually relying on our retail income or something, you know, a lot of people still work in fast food chains.
That could be so hard for the uni students, like, I mean, in the future. I'm thinking I'm lucky that I don't need to face that.
Already, I'm trying to not think about my hex debt because it's going to be so, take so long to pay off. So, yeah, that's going to be really hard.
What you've just heard is the steep divide between the government and the people who their tertiary education policy is affecting. The government is proposing changes to tertiary education under an efficiency dividend designed to reduce the cost from the sector and will see a $2.8 billion reduction in funding for universities, a gradual fee increase to tertiary degrees, and force students to start repaying any HECS or HELP loans when they begin earning $42,000 annually, lowered from $55,000.
No, I do not think that's a fair change. I think a lot of people might struggle with, especially the increasing living expenses in a city like Sydney, and having to also pay off their HECS debt at a lower income. It could be really problematic for some people.
That was Ruby. She's in her first year at the University of Technology, Sydney, and she represents one of many students who are worried about the government's changes. But they're not the only ones who are concerned about the upcoming changes. Belinda Robinson is CEO of Australian Universities and feels higher education is forced to bear the burden of budget repair too often.
Over the past 6 years, universities and their students have already contributed almost $4 billion to the budget repair effort of the government through a variety of different savings measures. And the second reason is that it's education, and particularly higher education, that is going to be the bedrock through the delivery of education, but also through their research programs in helping Australia make a successful transition to a new economy.
While opposed to the government's plan, Robinson is hoping that they won't have too great an impact on participation rates at university level.
We do have the HECS help scheme in Australia, and it is one of the most outstanding features of the higher education system in Australia compared with higher education systems in the US, for example. And that does mean that students are not required to pay anything up front in accessing or enrolling at university. And so, look, it's hard to say whether it is going to act as a disincentive. But what we do know is that university students are under you know, quite significant financial pressure.
One thing she was sure of, though, is that the changes could harm the future prospects of education being a leading export in Australia.
We absolutely need to keep our higher education system competitive as well. So there is a little bit of an inconsistency here. We have tax cuts for industry on the basis of international competitiveness, yet we have investment cuts to higher education and research, where the need for international competitive is just as strong. International education is Australia's third largest export industry, but more importantly than that, it's the key to ensuring that Australia is successfully making the transition to the future and in the maintenance of our social, cultural and economic prosperity.
Part of the criticism of the government's new plan for universities is that education should be considered a public good and not be targeted in the government's deficit reduction plans. However, Itama Chirastidam is a higher education research fellow with the Grattan Institute and takes a different view.
It's also important to recognise that, you know, someone's going to have to pay for this. Outstanding health debt is about $50 billion and about 25%, a quarter of that is not expected to be repaid. And someone's going to have to pay for that. You know, it's either us or, you know, the next generation or the next generation.
When asked whether or not the policy would be an effective one, Chirastidam was cautiously optimistic.
I think the idea of efficiency dividend is common in many industries. So, you know, when you have a kind of a larger scale, you're producing more profit, you know, efficiency dividend seems to make sense. Given what the minister said about the margin that has expanded for universities, it makes sense to actually share the burden on universities as well.
Despite Chirastidam's optimism, Belinda Robinson has vowed to engage the government over whether or not other policies can be sought after.
We will certainly be in conversation from today forward in relation to all of these key issues on keeping the Australian higher education and research system strong.
That was CEO of Universities Australia, Belinda Robinson, ending that report by Miles Holbrook-Walk. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio around Australia. I'm Shane Anderson. Protests have turned violent and a police officer was left with third-degree burns after a traditional May Day rally organised by unions turned ugly on the streets of Paris. At least four police officers were injured in the march, with social and political divisions rising to the forefront, this just days to go before the French presidential election. Wire executive producer Emma Lancaster spoke to on-the-ground reporter Stephanie Richards, who attended the May Day march.
Protesters in France threw petrol bombs at police during rallies marking the International Workers' Holiday of May Day, which turned violent in many capitals across Europe. One Paris police officer was seriously burnt and at least four others injured in confrontations with protesters. Wire reporter Stephanie Richard was on the ground in Paris when this action went down. She joins us on the line now. Stephanie, what happened at the May Day rally?
I wasn't like exactly right in the midst of the rally, but I was very much near it. I'm in Paris at the moment, as you said, and I was just walking along and I kept on noticing these massive groups of police officers who were fully armoured, and I thought something was going on. I had no idea that there was a protest planned. And then I was just sitting down at this bench and then all of a sudden there were gunshot kind of sounds coming out and screaming, not screaming, but just really loud, you know, people shouting, and there was just police everywhere. They started blocking off roads with tape. So traffic was a bit crazy and, yeah, obviously it was a bit of a tense atmosphere. At the same time, though, I think for me it was strange because I haven't been in Paris when an attack like this has happened before, but obviously for Parisians it's not, I wouldn't say a normal occurrence, but something that they're becoming more and more accustomed to. And so for the Parisians it wasn't as though they were that scared. For them it was more of an inconvenience that, you know, roads were being blocked off and, you know, they were had these gunshots. They weren't exactly scared, but for me, as a tourist, someone that isn't accustomed to that in Paris, I was quite scared.
So do you think these tensions then between the protesters and police are perhaps a sign of the political and social divisions boiling away in France in the lead-up to the French presidential election?
I don't think it's necessarily the protesters angry at the police. I think it's the protesters that are angry at the country as a whole for getting to the stage where they're faced with an extreme right-wing candidate facing up against a centralist candidate who isn't necessarily what everyone had expected at the end. I think a lot of protesters and a lot of French people in general are just very disheartened at the moment. They're probably very angry at the current political situation, and they're using protests like this to try and find an escape or a release from this kind of political angst.
Now, there are just days to go until the French presidential election. Emmanuel Macron is the front runner, but he still faces challenges ahead of Sunday's second round vote. Although for many, the campaign has become less about backing Macron and instead perhaps about voting against his far-right National Front rival, Marine Le Pen. What are your thoughts on who's likely to become president, and what do you think we're likely to see come Sunday your time?
From my perspective, I definitely think that Macron would win. It was interesting. I think it was yesterday Marine Le Pen actually did gain up a bit on Macron, so that's interesting. But I think for many French people, they just think that it's without a doubt Macron will win, 100% sure. And I think the same. I think that whilst Marine Le Pen does have quite a solid support base, and whilst she does, you know, she can, you know, use terrorist attacks for her political advantage, and she can, you know, kind of garner this fear in Europe at the moment for her political advantage, I think that French people will end up choosing Macron. Just because Marine Le Pen is on the extreme right, a lot of French people are wary of the extreme left and the extreme right historically after the Second World War. And I think that many people will vote for Macron against Le Pen.
That was Stephanie Richards, Y reporter in Paris, ending that report.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
This is The Wire on community and Indigenous radio across Australia. And hello if you're listening in Tubob Radio in Taree. A report released by the Australian government has found a widespread problem with dumped asbestos in and around remote Indigenous communities. And the cost of removing the deadly fibres in these communities can be up to three times higher than for other parts of the country. Whilst the Commonwealth and Northern Territory governments are bickering over who should foot the clean-up bill, experts are calling for a renewed asbestos awareness campaign targeted at Indigenous corporations and land councils.
My name is Malcolm Wall. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of an Aboriginal corporation, which is Yuppa Kalunga Mutura Aboriginal Corporation. We basically look after a huge area of land out here. Just the land trust is 2,500 square kilometres. We're all about getting people back, getting Indigenous people, the Yuppa from out here, back living on the land.
Malcolm Wall lives in Yuendumu, a small remote Indigenous community about 300 kilometres northwest of Alice Springs. In Yuendumu, and many Indigenous communities across the Northern Territory, the fear of asbestos exposure is an everyday reality. Dumps of old building materials filled with the toxic substance surround the town, and old churches and offices built with asbestos still stand. In the late 1970s and early 80s, Australia was one of the highest users of asbestos per capita in the world. It was used to build and insulate houses because it was cheap and effective. But now that we know asbestos is dangerous and causes cancer, we are ripping it out of our walls and getting rid of it any way we can. While Australia is doing everything they can to protect themselves from asbestos, the remote Indigenous communities of Australia are the ones being hit hardest. When you're out there working on the land, do you see this problem? Do you see it physically?
Absolutely. All the time. I remember as a kid in primary school, and there was a leprosarium in Darwin out at East Darwin. Where there's a big
a leprosarium there. Is a hospital where people used to be treated for leprosy.
And my father, he used to run the church at the leprosarium.
Now, the Leprosarium closed, and my father was asked whether he wanted to remove that church building. And myself and a mate of mine, who we were both 12, went out and helped my father remove that old building. And he gave us a couple of jimmy bars each, and we went through and removed all the asbestos sheeting. Except what we did was we had a ball. We smashed every sheet because it goes off, you know, and there's dust everywhere. At the end of the day, mate of mine and I, we were covered in white dust, walking around laughing. It was hilarious. And my father thought it was hilarious as well. Now, this is back in the very early 80s. You know, people have been exposed to it. I've been exposed to it.
Even though the height of asbestos use in the country was in the early 80s, and that is when Wall thinks he was exposed, the aftermath is still widespread in remote Indigenous communities.
One of the dumps we've got, you know, hasn't been in use effectively for, what, probably pushing 30 years. As you walk through that area out there, it's all over it. And to physically get in there and pick it up and remove it, it's an impossibility. And, you know, this is just one community. You know, there's, what, there's about 80 communities, you know, townships in the Northern Territory, and I dare every single one of those would have the same issue.
Yesterday, the Asbestos Safety and Eradication Agency released a report about the problem and identified that when dealing with asbestos, remote and rural communities face problems people in cities might not. This is Tanya Segaloff from Segaloff Taylor Lawyers. She has represented asbestos sufferers for more than two decades.
There's a number of issues with rural communities, and some of those issues are unique to rural communities, and some of them are just issues that are prevalent everywhere throughout Australia but become a bigger issue in rural communities.
Segaloff says one of these issues is geography. Towns like Yuendumu are far removed from major cities, and this makes it harder for towns and governments to remove the cancer-causing fibre.
A huge amount of it is the distance and the lack of facility. So there's not people, you have to bring in people to remove it because there would not be specialists in the area who are trained. And then if there are no waste facilities that are licensed to take asbestos, you've then got to transport it to a waste facility and get rid of it there. So a lot of it is the isolation.
Is it more expensive to remove asbestos in regional communities?
For sure it is, because it has to be removed to a dump, a waste facility that is licensed to manage asbestos, and there are very few in regional communities, and it has to be transported there, and all that has to be done safely.
According to the Asbestos Safety and Eradication Report, one of the reasons Indigenous communities are affected the most is because of public housing that was built by the Commonwealth and is now falling apart before their eyes. Many of these communities affected think it's the government's job to come clean up the problem they created.
One of the problems in a lot of communities, particularly Aboriginal communities, is there's a lot of time spent fighting about who's responsible. Is it the local government? Is it the state government? Is it the federal government? Is it an Aboriginal corporation? And there's a lot of buck passing. And while there's a lot of passing going on, the materials stay there and they're exposing people to dangerous and toxic material.
And even though Minister for Indigenous Affairs, Senator Nigel Scullion, has addressed the issue and has taken some responsibility, Malcolm Wall thinks governments at both the state and federal level need to step up and address the issue.
Government's job is to take responsibility for this stuff, so they need to. They need to bite the bullet, and they need to remember that this ain't got nothing to do with politics. This cancer you get from asbestos, it's not racist. They don't care who you are. It doesn't care who you are. It doesn't care where you're from, which part of the world you're from, mate. Asbestos is lethal, and it's not racist, and it's not political.
That was Malcolm Wall, CEO of the Yuppa Kulunga Yura, ending that report by Miles Herbert. Thanks to quotas, the proportion of women in parliaments across the world has nearly doubled in the past 20 years. The Australian Human Rights Commission recently released a proposal that would require private companies bidding for government contracts to include a clause in their contracts that would require successful bidders to demonstrate efforts to improve gender balance. This includes a hiring target rate of 40% women. Former Prime Minister Tony Abbott has labelled the recommendations as anti-men. But could quotas make gender equality happen in the workplace? Bronte Walker investigates.
Obviously, we have to give women a fair go. We absolutely have to give women a fair go. But some of this stuff sounds like it's just anti-men.
That was former Prime Minister Tony Abbott talking to Ray Hadley on 2GB about the recent Australian Human Rights Commission recommendation to the Senate inquiry into gender segregation. The recommendation would require any government-contracted organisation to demonstrate efforts to improve gender balance, with an ultimate goal of reaching 40-40-20 gender balance, 40% men, 40% women, and 20% unspecified to allow for flexibility.
I think there's a few commentators out there who have an interest in sort of pushing along the fairly hyperbolic line around anything that goes towards pushing gender equality in the workforce. But I think we need to start from the beginning about where criticisms and the hot under the collarness comes about the quotas and other disruptors for gender inequality. And that basically is that people are assuming the situation we have now is a meritocracy and that merit produces the best possible person. And we know from years of research that, in fact, the system we have at the moment doesn't actually generate equality and isn't based on a gender-neutral ways of thinking or ways of acting. So what we're trying to do is think about ways that we can disrupt what is essentially, you know, a negative situation for women rather than to do something that's negative towards men. And I think that people who are like to make mischief and love a good headline around being anti-man or around, you know, destroying businesses really are being a little mischievous and not quite getting to the point that what we're trying to do here is not to disadvantage men but to actually be able to put a situation where we genuinely are putting forward the best candidates for jobs and that we're not cutting out half of the population in the form of women for those roles.
That was Associate Professor Ray Cooper, co-director of the Women, Work, Leadership Research Group at University of Sydney Business School.
You know, if you look at the indicators, and that's around things such as women in senior and strategic roles, if we look at the gender pay gap, and we look at things such as gender segregation, in fact, we are scarily not moving in the right direction. Just looking at the gender pay gap, in the period for which we've had really strong data, which is over the last 30 years, the gender pay gap has moved up and down a little bit, but basically it's been tracking between about 17 and 22-23% over all of that time. So we haven't seen any massive disruption there, and that's despite the fact that we know that it's there, we know what many of the drivers are, we still don't seem to be taking action on it. Despite the fact that women are voting with their feet and moving into the labour force in much greater numbers, we just don't seem to be getting that traction and allowing women to be rewarded in the way that they should be for their investment in things such as education. So I think, you know, we have moved and education is one great example of where we've done, you know, made some massive leaps. But I tell you what, it's not paying off in the labour force.
There are arguments against the recommendation of gender quotas, which include that they're a form of discrimination against men and will result in the token woman taking on a non-merit-based role. There have also been concerns raised that if gender balance requirements are imposed on government contractors, there could be flow-on effects, including less competition, potentially a bad outcome for taxpayers.
Look, I think governments can use the power of the public purse to drive positive outcomes, but they do need to be very cautious in ensuring that their procurement policies are simple and accessible and encourage competition for those wanting to provide services to government. So in this regard, we think that gender quotas could have some unintended consequences because as taxpayers, we also want governments to be getting the best products and services, you know, at the best price for the taxpayer. So I think the government can play a key role in gender diversity, and that could be through promoting and encouraging leading practices, many of which organisations are already adopting, and encouraging them in their efforts to take advantage of the opportunities and benefits of employing more diverse workforces. However, we do think that imposing government rules through the procurement system to achieve those outcomes may not necessarily be the best way to go about it.
That was Alana Matheson, the Deputy Director of Work Placement Relations of the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry. And can you just explain to our listeners some of the economic impacts which would result if such a quota program was introduced in Australia?
Look, I think you would see potentially, and I'm talking about sectors or work types, if you like, where there is dominance of a particular gender. It could be dominance of women in some workplaces, or it could be dominance of men. You might have a situation where you're seeing very few contractors able to tender to do certain projects for government. That could have some unintended consequences in terms of the cost, the quality, because you're restricting competition in the market to deliver those services. So that's where we think the government should exercise some particular caution.
Although the recommendation was put forward by the Australian Human Rights Commission, it is unclear whether the government is looking to adopt these measures. Achieving gender equality will require a significant cultural change that may or may not be addressed by body counting the number of women in the workplace.
Wire reporter Bronte Walker ending that report. Wherever you are on Indigenous and community radio around Australia, hello, I'm Shane Anderson and you're with The Wire.
That
That's it for The Wire today. You can find all our stories online at thewire.org.au, or you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your favourite download app. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. The Wire is a team effort by 2SER, Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane, and you can hear us on your radio or online across Australia weekdays. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of 2SER 107.3 in Sydney. I'm Shane Anderson. Thanks for your company.
An opportunity of a lifetime to enhance your skills overseas and expand your global networks awaits you. The Australian Government's Australia Awards, Endeavour Scholarships and Fellowships provides financial support for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples to undertake study, professional development or research overseas towards an Australian Master's, PhD or postdoctoral research in any field. Further your studies around the world and improve the outcomes for future generations of Indigenous Australians. For more information, see the Endeavour Scholarships and Fellowships website.
2SER sponsors.